When Tayemba Jess set out to tell the stories of African-American creatives from the 19th to early 20th century, he had no idea that the resulting book of poetry would go on to win several awards, including the 2017 Pulitzer Prize. Olio is a large collection of sonnets, songs, and art that explores and challenges contemporary notions of race and identity by melding Jess's slam poetry experience with the influences of those who have gone before him.
I also had the good luck of being able to be in on the ground floor of an organization called Kavikana, which represented the idea that your poetry doesn't have to be one particular thing in order for it to be a black poem. I just want it to be the best poem it can be, and through that I am expressing my blackness.
Yeah. Tayemba Jess talks about his craft with Kansas City's 18th and Vine Jazz District's poet laureate, Glenn North, recorded when Jess was visiting in 2019 as part of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, which 2 years earlier had designated KC as the U.S. Creative City of Music. Jess had met the two local organizers, Anita Dixon and Jake Wagner, at another UNESCO gathering in Krakow, Poland. We'll hear more about that later, but first, let's listen to part of his reading from the multi-award-winning book, Olio, at the Kansas City Public Library. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, and here's Tayemba Jess.
The Olio was the part of the minstrel show that was a variety act. Could have a singer, a dancer, a musician, a joke teller, etc., all coming together in that middle part of the minstrel show. Towards the end of the 19th, early 20th century, the minstrel show kind of faded away, but, you know, the Olio kind of developed in what we know as vaudeville. Then you have Broadway, of course, the great white way, so to speak, of America, right? So the question that drove this book was, what was the sound of black music before it was being recorded? Who was playing the jazz really before it was called jazz? Who was playing the ragtime before it was being really recorded, etc.? And my investigation led me into the characters that are in the book, Olio, speaking out from the poems. So I'd like to introduce you to the characters, Millie and Christine McCoy. These are the McCoy twins. They were born in North Carolina. Yes, they're twins. They're not just ordinary twins. They are Pygopagus twins. Very, very rare to find a set of surviving Pygopagus twins. The odds are against you if you're born in this particular fashion. Joined from the bottom of the rib cage all the way through the spine, all the way through the pelvis, with two separate sets of legs. Of course, the rest of them being separate. Very, very rare to find them surviving. But they survived not just birth, but life through slavery and beyond, right? And my question was, well, how did that happen? What was the story for the McCoy twins? And I wanted to make some poems that tried to capture their experience. So this is the first poem in the series of poems about Christine and Millie McCoy. So what this is, for those of you who love poetry, this is a sonnet. A sonnet is a form of poem. It's roughly 500-600 years old. These are Shakespearean sonnets because they're in the style of Shakespeare, meaning they follow a certain poetic rhythm, which goes A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G, like you're stuttering through the alphabet. But the purpose of these syncopated sonnets is that they tell two stories at the same time in the same poem. And if we read down the middle of the poem, we find the conjoined voices of the McCoy twins. If we read down either side, we find Millie's voice and Christine's voice. If we read down the middle, we're fused in blood and body from one thrum stem, budding twin blooms of song. We're a double rose grown from hard labor that made our mother shout, spent with awe. We hymn to pay soft homage, born of and beyond the flesh. We are just two women singing truths we can't forget. And if we read on Millie's side of the poem, we've minted two songs in the one dark skin, bleeding soprano into contralto, descended from raw carnage of the South, bursting open our freedom. We sing past rage to the work song's aria. It leaves us soaked in history like our father's sweat from plantation to grave. Lord, here we are, free twin sisters who've hauled our voices far. And on Christine's side of the poem, We ride the wake of each other's rhythm, beating our hearts' syncopated tempo with a music all our own. With our mouths seeped in the glow of hand-me-down courage, drenched in spiritual acapellas, flowing soul from bone through skin. We pay debts from broken travel to circus stars. We sing straight from this nation's barbed-wired heart. You're skipping lines in that reading. You're experiencing what's called an interstitial reading, just skipping lines, right? But when you read it all together as one body of a poem, and imagine the two twins standing in front of us and speaking or singing their lines together. We've mended two songs into one dark skin. We ride the wake of each other's rhythm, bleeding soprano into contralto, beating our hearts' syncopated tempo. We're fused in blood and body from one thrum stem, budding twin blooms of song. We're a double rose descended from raw carnage of the South with a music all our own. With our mouths bursting open our freedom, we sing past rage, seeped in the glow of hand-me-down courage, grown from hard labor that made our mother shout, spent with all. We hymn to pay soft homage to the work song's aria. It leaves us drenched in spiritual acapellas, soaked in history like our father's sweat, flowing soul from bone through skin. We pay debts born of and beyond the flesh. We are just two women singing truths we can't forget from plantation to grave. Lord, here we are, from broken chattel to circus stars. Free twin sisters who've hauled our voices far. We sing straight from this nation's barbed-wired heart.
That's a sampling from the series of poems about the twins Millie and Christine McCoy from Tayemba Jess's Pulitzer Prize-winning collection, Oleo. Published by Wave Books, it won two more awards and was a finalist for three others. You can find a link to hear the rest of this 2019 Kansas City Public Library reading on our website, newletters.org. Born in Detroit in 1965, Tayemba Jess earned his B.A. degree from the University of Chicago and his MFA from New York University. He was an early Cave Canem Fellow with that now-famous Black Poetry Workshop, founded in 1996 by Toy Derricotte and Cornelius Eady. So it's only appropriate that Tayemba Jess, whose first poetry book was called Lead Belly, after the historic musician, should sit down with Kansas City's Poet Laureate of the 18th and Vine Jazz District, also a Cave Canem Fellow, Glenn North.
I really want to talk about Oleo. You know, you were at the Kansas City Public Library.
Yeah.
And you did this incredible reading. To me, Oleo is so much more than just a collection of poetry. It's visual art. It has this really performative component. It's a lesson in history. It's a reclamation. And so I just wanted you to talk a little bit about the book, especially in a way that people who may not be familiar with it, let's whet their appetite.
Okay. Well, Oleo is essentially a collection of the voices of African-American creatives that were trying to make their art come to fruition, I want to say, around the time of the Civil War and just before the Civil War up until World War I.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a collection of creative voices such as Scott Joplin, the creator of Ragtime, Blind Tom, who was an autistic and blind piano player who was owned by the family that owned him through slavery, continued to own him throughout his life until he died in the early years of the 20th century. Blind Boone, who was also blind and had his eyes taken out of his head when he was 6 months old. Sissy Retta Jones, who was the first Black person to sing at Carnegie Hall before it was even called Carnegie Hall. Edmonia Lewis, sculptor, Fisk Jubilee singers, Henry Box Brown, the McCoy twins. All of these people are kind of roaming around in this book telling their stories in the format called an oleo.
Yeah.
And the oleo is the vestige of the minstrel show. It's the middle part of the minstrel show when a variety of acts would come together and entertain the crowd.
What was it in the process of writing the book, or when was it that it clicked that I really want this book to have this very visual aspect as well?
That kind of crept up in the book. It came through a fusion of form and function.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a series of contrapuntal poems in the book. That's one of the themes of the book, is counterpointed poems. In other words, there's a sonnet, which is a 14-line poem, which is talking back line by line to another sonnet that's right next to it.
Right.
And those sonnets can be read individually or they can be read across the page.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when you fuse them further, they start to share lines in the middle, and they can be read down and then up and diagonally down and then diagonally up in whichever direction the reader wants to go. That idea came out of the idea of allowing these folks to talk back in history to their counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, there's a dialogue between Blind Tom and Blind Boone. There's dialogue between Mark Twain and Blind Tom. There's a continual dialogue between these conjoined twins. They're Pygopagus twins who were very famous in the 19th century, called the McCoy twins.
Mm-hmm.
There's this continual back and forth and call and response between historical figures that happens in the book that was not really able to happen necessarily at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's a reimagining of what that dialogue would look like.
Yeah.
And that caused a lot of the visual terrain of the book to come to fruition.
And it doesn't feel gimmicky at all. What is it that inspires you or keeps you exploring how these poems can be read and interpreted and received in so many different ways?
The idea of a technique lapsing into a gimmick mm-hmm. is kind of what has kept me really focused on trying to not use the contrapuntal form in a way that does not serve the understanding, a further understanding of the conflict or the relationship between the people mm-hmm. in their time and in their own relationship. And I think for me, it becomes a little bit of a puzzle.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
The puzzle is to try and get the historical issues. For instance, McCoy twins were wise enough and talented enough to buy their own property at one point, which happened to be the plantation upon which they were once slaves.
That's an incredible story.
It's an amazing story. Yeah. And trying to get the essence of them traveling and becoming famous and then gathering the money to buy the land
mm-hmm.
and trying to get all those historical points. I'd done some contrapuntal poems in Lead Belly,
mm-hmm.
and I just felt like I wanted to raise the ante.
You did.
So to
speak. Boy.
But it was important to keep the focus on the lives of the people and not the function of form. Say, for instance, there's a poem about Mark Twain. In that case, I used an actual quote from Mark Twain, and I delineate it in a particular way that helps it match up against a corresponding dialogue mm-hmm. with Blind Tom. And in that case, you have an actual quote that you can bounce back and forth in between and discover a different understanding of Blind Tom.
Yeah. I am Glenn North, sitting with the incomparable Taimba Jess, who is an incredible poet, one of my literary heroes. So I would love for you to just pick a piece that you would like to share with the listeners.
Since we were talking about these contrapuntal poems, mm-hmm. I think there's one I can give to the audience that if they follow closely,
mm-hmm.
then they'll be able to see the difference or see what's happening with the contrapuntal form. And this is a poem with Mark Twain versus Blind Tom.
Okay.
Blind Tom was born blind and autistic in 1849 in Georgia. And he became a very famous piano player, although he was owned by the Bethune family
mm-hmm.
throughout the years of slavery. And then after the Civil War, they continued to basically own him because they had locked him into contracts contrary to his mother's wishes. And they continued to hold him, so mm-hmm. to speak, and to profit from his performances to the tune of $1 million.
Which was a lot of money now, but a whole lot of money
in the
1800s. Certainly.
And one of his fans was Mark Twain. And Mark Twain once wrote about him saying this following quote: "Some archangel, cast out of upper heaven like another Satan, inhabits this coarse casket, and he comforts himself and makes his prison beautiful with thoughts and dreams and memories of another time and another existence that fire this dull clod with impulses and inspirations it no more comprehends than does the stupid worm the stirring of the spirit within her of the gorgeous captive whose wings she fetters and whose flight she stays." And I wanted to take that quote and have Tom answer it with these words. I'm sent from above, like rain on blue prayers. Blessed with Gabriel's lost notes, I can see up to God's throne, yes, while he plays this soul of flesh free. Makes me the music of piano, the breath and burn and the storm clouds roar from when sound called up, first made me whole. Sounds like love. Weighted in my chest, it finds freedom after hurt. I hear earth tremble harsher, better than the soil itself. When land and trees sing to me, I hear notes wildly blooming inside. A spirit shadows across my face, breaking free, unloosed. I play the wind in my blood. So when you take that quote from Mark Twain and counterpose it with lines from the Blind Tom imaginary quote. It reads as such, going from Mark Twain to Blind Tom and back and forth. It reads as such. Some archangel, I'm sent from above, cast out of upper heaven like rain on blue prayers, like another Satan blessed with Gabriel's lost notes, I inhabits this coarse casket, can see up to God's throne, yes, and he comforts himself while he plays this soul and makes his prison of flesh free. Makes me beautiful with the music of piano, the thoughts and breath and dreams and burn in the memories of storm clouds roar from another time when sound called up and another existence first made me whole. That fire sounds like love. This dull clod weighted in my chest with impulses and inspirations, it finds freedom after it no more comprehends hurt. I hear earth tremble harsher than does the stupid worm, better than the soil itself. When the stirring of the spirit within land and trees sing to me, I hear her notes of the wildly gorgeous captive blooming inside. A spirit whose wings she shadows across my face, fetters breaking free and unloosed. I play the wind whose flight she stays in my blood.
Mark Twain versus Blind Tom. This contrapuntal poem features a found quote from Twain in Tyemba Jess's second book, Olio. He's talking here on New Letters on the Air with fellow poet and Kansas City's Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center and Museum Executive Director, Glenn North.
So the performative aspect, I know that back in the day you did some slam poetry.
Yep.
As someone who kind of got my start with spoken word and is kind of trying to evolve into all these different things that poetry can be, I love that you have been able to bring that to bear on the work that you do. And it comes across very well when you read, man. And I love poetry and all its manifestations. But some readings, quite frankly, are kind of stiff.
I know.
And quiet, and that certainly doesn't happen with you. But having said that, one thing that I haven't mentioned, and I know you probably talked about this ad infinitum, but the Pulitzer, man.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
It's been a real honor to be able to share this work in that light. I think also I like the idea that I'm sharing these stories. I just felt like these folks deserve to have their names said by more people in the 21st century.
I get that.
And to have the honor of the Pulitzer to help give gravity to those names is a real blessing. It's way more than I thought was going to happen.
Yeah.
So I'm just really glad to have it.
Yeah.
And just to have the book out. The Wave people did a fantastic job on the production of the book.
It's a beautiful book, it's well put together.
They're bibliophiles. Mm-hmm. They believe in the power of this ancient technology called the book.
Right, right.
In an era when everybody's reading things off their screens all the time.
Yeah.
And that was another part of the ethos of the book, is that enjoying the technology.
It was quite a feat. You know, for those who may not have seen the book, it's, I would say, oversized. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm
It's basically 8.5 by 11.
Yeah, 8.5 by 11. So, you know, you got different fonts, you got artwork, you got those four fold-out pages.
That tear out of the book very, very cleanly.
Absolutely.
And it's 235 pages.
Yeah. So, shout out to Wave Books for believing in you and for the work that they do, because the book works on so many layers, but it's just a beautiful piece of art.
Thank you. And yeah, they did a much better job than I thought. Yeah.
And so it was like a pleasant surprise when you finally saw the completed project.
I knew they were on it, but I didn't know they were like on it. There's a great visual artist. Her name's Jessica Lynn Brown.
Yeah.
She's from the Midwest. She's from up near Missouri way. Her artwork is in it, and I think it's a stunning compliment to what's happening in the stories in the book.
One thing I've been dying to ask you, let's take the focus off of you for a second. You sucking up all that limelight. No, it's all good. I'm just teasing, man. But I know that you had an opportunity to meet and work with Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yeah.
Yeah, who also won the Pulitzer Prize. So
right.
I don't know how close you all were, but what was it like?
Well, I saw her reading around town from time to time. And I got to see her at the Chicago State Black Writers Conference a few times, led by Hakeem Adubuti back in the day.
Sure.
And got to see her do her thing. She was really a poetry saint in Chicago. People may not know, but she was very generous. She had a habit of having impromptu poetry contests where she'd give out like actual money.
Yeah.
I won a slam once. This had to be 93, 94, something like that. And I got to meet her and talk to her and just kind of soak her up for a little. But she was very modest, very focused on her work, but also on her community. I think that's the thing about her. You know, she didn't leave the South Side. She went out to elementary schools and was just like a real patron saint of poetry.
Yeah.
She was the first Black Pulitzer. I mean, you know, I can't imagine the kind of, you know, gravity and weight that goes with that. But she carried it gracefully and well. And, you know, I think she made some very fierce political choices in terms of who was publishing her. She left a major press and she signed all her work to Third World Press.
Yeah.
This is in the 1960s.
Right.
Third World Press was just a broadside press, I believe, first. These are little Black presses.
Yeah.
You know, that she took her work and entrusted it to them. And that was a huge political choice that she stood by, the way she stood by the community. So she influenced a lot of people. I think it'd be very hard not to be influenced by Gwendolyn Brooks.
You're listening to Tayemba Jess, winner of the Gwendolyn Brooks Open Mic Poetry Award back in 2001. This Lennon Literary Award winner was also named a 2018 Guggenheim Fellow. Again, here's College of Staten Island Professor Tayemba Jess with poet Glenn North.
You've been teaching poetry for quite a while now.
Yeah.
You know, I know there's no magic formula, but for me, one of the things I really talk to the students that I work with about is making sure that they're reading a lot of good poetry. Like, that's critical. And I encourage them to be active readers, you know.
Right.
And even if you don't like a poem that you come across, what is it doing? What poetic devices are being utilized effectively? What thematically can you borrow from that in terms of the way the poet is writing about a certain subject that can inform the way you want to write about something, all of those kind of things. But what have you found to be some kind of key elements to helping students write and become better poets?
Well, number one, you know, reading. As you said, I want them to walk away from my classes with a fundamental understanding that they have to read. And they have to read broadly, not just poetry, but
that's right.
You know,
that's
fiction,
right. Sure.
Plays, whatever it is. I draw a relationship between writing and music, because if you're gonna play the guitar, then you're gonna listen to people that play the guitar.
That's right.
And you're actually gonna learn songs that other people wrote.
That's it.
So for some reason, when it comes to literature, some people are like, no, I don't want to be influenced by so-and-so and such and such.
Yeah, I tell them that talent borrows, but genius robs.
Well,
you know. take it all, put your own spin on it, man, make it yours.
And I would say beyond that, I think I try to concentrate on the image, because the image can carry the story or the idea so much more effectively than trying to explain a particular emotion or a kind of sensibility. I think I learned a lot of this by reading Youssef Kominyaka, who is all about the subversiveness of the image.
Yeah.
and reading his work and discovering, you know, I think that's the first book I read Neon Vernacular, and I was like, man, I remember telling my friend, man, this is like 3D.
Yeah.
Like, you're in the foxhole or mm-hmm. Going down into the tunnel in mm-hmm. Vietnam, or mm-hmm. you're in the space mm-hmm. when you're reading the poem.
Yeah.
And there's no real substitute for that.
I agree.
Yeah. So I am about reading an image, and also I am about folks understanding the history of the places where they're from and
yeah.
where they're living.
I'm so glad you said that, because yeah. if you know A. Van Jordan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I took a workshop with him, mm-hmm. and he challenged me, being from Kansas City, him being from Ohio, to write about where you're from. Right. And there's not enough voices coming out of the Midwest.
It's true.
And he wasn't even talking about black at that point. He mm-hmm. was talking about regional, you
right.
know, and yeah. talking about what has been going on in the places that we're from and right. looking at local history.
Kansas City has this rich jazz legacy.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
And a shout out to Anita Dixon.
Mm-hmm.
who
yeah.
really kind of made this thing happen mm-hmm. and brought me here to share this work, because she's done such a lot of amazing work around the issue of rediscovering or reclaiming mm-hmm. our heritage
yeah.
in this region of the country.
Mm-hmm.
There's all this energy happening around this area.
Absolutely.
Kansas City, Memphis,
yeah.
you know, and Sedalia.
Yeah.
It's like a Bermuda Triangle of sound.
Yeah,
you know?
Of sound.
Yeah,
okay.
It's an amazing uh-huh. space.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the history around here, we like to say that the jazz was born in New Orleans, but it grew up in Kansas City. So,
uh-huh.
you know, Charlie Parker,
mm-hmm.
Jay McShann, yeah. Count Basie. How could I forget Count Basie?
Basie.
Come on, man.
Right.
So anyway, there's this great musical tradition, and there's a lot of great young musicians who are performing now. So what Anita's done is Kansas City's been designated a music city by UNESCO. Which
is how I met Anita.
Exactly. You know, you could probably speak to it even more clearly than I could,
mm-hmm.
but I know that distinction really is profound in
yeah.
terms of people understanding on a global level how important Kansas City has been to the evolution of this very powerful music.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I met Anita and Jacob,
mm-hmm.
Jacob Wagner, in Poland,
mm-hmm.
in Krakow.
Of all places.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I was fortunate enough to give a presentation that must have been about 140 countries.
Mm-hmm.
UNESCO has cities of literature, cities mm-hmm. of music, cities of, I believe, all kinds of different disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing is that Jacob and Anita worked together to make this, I think it's the only UNESCO city of music
yes.
in the United States. Which is amazing.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
You know, that's being sharp. I mean,
yeah.
you know, Kansas City got a coup.
Yeah, for
here,
sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I believe that what that allows for is a different level of international fellowship
mm-hmm.
of people from around the world who can share information and share facilities in order to bring guests in
yes.
and more effectively share their histories,
mm-hmm.
you know? So that's how I met. I had to go to Poland to
yeah.
come to Kansas City. That's how it is.
Well, we're glad
from that Krakow to Kansas,
ain't
baby.
That right?
Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Tayemba Jess was here in UNESCO's Creative City of Music in 2019. For links to Jess, UNESCO, and an earlier show featuring Glenn North's poetry, visit newletters.org. While you're there, explore our magazine, books, and contests. And if you appreciate our work, please consider making a tax-deductible donation to help match funds from other sources. Look for the Support New Letters button in the top right-hand corner of newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was produced with Robert Zimmerman, Natalie Stein, Ashley Coate, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.